Welcome to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, we have rape at BYU, the Salt Flats, politics, and much more. And joining me this morning in studio, Salt Lake Tribune environmental reporter Emma Penrod is here. Emma, good morning to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us, health, education, and environment editor Rachel Piper joins us. Rachel, good morning.
Good morning, Jennifer.
And senior political reporter Robert Gerke is with us as well. Robert, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you are welcome to join us with the stories on your mind. You can put your comments at sltrib.com. You can tweet that hashtag is TribTalk or give us a call. 801-355-TALK is that number. Big week on Capitol Hill. Lots happening during the interim session. Let's start with the bear's ears controversy. The state legislature met, passed a resolution on national monuments. So, Robert, what's the intent here?
Well, the resolution just basically says that the legislature and the governor strongly oppose the creation of or President Obama's proposed, I guess, use of the Antiquities Act to create the 1.9 million acre Bears Ears National Monument down in southeastern Utah. This is not new. I mean, they've been opposing this in every way imaginable for some time. The governor's delivered letters directly to President Obama requesting that he wait. The federal delegation has weighed in opposition to it. But this is essentially just another. You know, they're saying it again, I guess. But it's such a contentious battle. I mean, this week up at the Capitol, we had opponents of the monument, American Indian tribal members who were opposed to the monument. We had another rally the next day of those who were in support of it. And essentially, the message that they're trying to send is, I guess, twofold. One, that they would like to see the public lands initiative that Representative Rob Bishop has proposed move forward, and that would create a smaller area that would be a national conservation area rather than a national monument. And the argument there is that a national conservation area would give the tribes a little bit more latitude to go in there and do these things that they've traditionally done there, gather wood, gather berries and nuts, that sort of thing. And the second part, I guess, is that the legislature and the governor want some say in whether there is a monument created down there. And so the resolution also requests, they can't direct, but a request to the Attorney General take any legal action available to oppose such a monument if one is created.
There was a rally at the Capitol. We have these dueling claims of where Native American tribes come down on the Bears Ears area. So do tribes support the monument or do they not support the monument?
It's a little tricky to sort through. The main opponent of the monument is the San Juan County Commissioner, Rebecca Benally. She's a member of the Navajo Nation, and the Aneth chapter of the Navajo had originally passed a resolution in support. The Aneth chapter is the one that's predominantly on Utah's side. They passed a resolution in support of the monument, and then they rescinded that. So, but you also on the other side have Mark Maryboy and members of the Navajo Nation. You've got two Navajo council members who've voted in support of this. You've got tribes like the Ute Mountain Tribe. You've got the Paiute and the Zunis that have all written letters in support of this. And on Wednesday, after their rally at the Capitol, they delivered those letters to the governor's office. I don't want to say it's split because it's not evenly split, I don't think. You've got proponents from a number of tribes, including the National Congress of American Indians, which is the national group, and other tribes in the region who are in support of this. And then in opposition to it, you do have some people who are concerned, members of the Navajo Nation who are concerned that if they do pass this monument, it will actually restrict them from getting access to the areas that have been sacred to them for hundreds of years, and make it harder for them to actually use the land for its traditional purposes. So they're trying to balance that. Now, a lot of those decisions actually end up being made in a monument management plan. If it comes to that, they're not necessarily that when a monument's declared, there's not some blanket restriction on it. It's kind of the BLM goes through and manages those as they see fit. So there is some question about how restrictive a monument designation would be. The argument that the opponents of the monument creation make is that if it is a conservation area, they have a lot more say in how it's managed. There's actually, under the Public Lands Initiative that Representative Bishop is proposing, there's actually a board that's established that has members of the nation and other groups that would vote and sort of manage the conservation area a little bit more democratically, I guess you'd say.
What about Utahns generally? There's been some polling activity on this,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess the good news is whichever side of the argument you're on, you have a poll that supports your viewpoint, because there were two polls that came out this week. One was from a an environmental group that said that 71% of Utahns support creation of the Bears Ears National Monument. The next day, Utah Policy and Dan Jones came out with a poll that said 17% of the state supports creation of the Bears Ears National Monument. So you're in pretty good shape, whichever side of this argument you're on in terms of polling. There were concerns about the environmental poll that the way the question is phrased in both polls sort of helped drive the outcome, I think. And so it's a little hard to tell exactly where the public is on this. There's not a clear-cut answer to that, I don't think.
The governor did sign the resolution. Did he make remarks at that time?
He made some remarks yesterday during his monthly news conference, I guess there were two points that he made. One is that the Democrats were arguing that this resolution is so strongly worded that it's sort of a slap in the face to the president, and any sort of incentive he would have to work with the delegation and work with Utahns in creating this monument would sort of go by the wayside, and he would be given more incentive to actually go ahead and create the monument before he leaves office. The governor said that he doesn't believe that's the case. He said he takes the president at his word, and he's had meetings with the president and the vice president and the interior secretary and the director of the Bureau of Land Management, and they've all assured him that they're not going to kind of come in the middle of the night and create a monument the way that President Clinton did. It was interesting. I talked to Jacqueline Orton, who is Bill Orton's widow, on Wednesday. And
was she at the Capitol?
She was up at the Capitol. She's a strong supporter of Bears Ears National Monument, but she said that the process for this one has been entirely different than the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, when her husband went to the White House several times and said, you know, are you going to create a monument? And was assured that they weren't, and then got a phone call at 2 a.m. from the president on Air Force One flying out for the ceremony.
Oh, by the way.
By the way, yeah, I remember what we said about that. So she said the process in this one's been entirely different, that the congressional delegation has an open door, that the tribes have met with the president, that the governor's met with the president and the interior secretary. And so there's been a considerable amount of public input on this on both sides, and in her opinion, the people who are opposing the monument and saying that, you know, the president's not listening are just upset that they're not getting the results that they want. You have people on the other side, Representative Mike Noel, Representative Ken Ivory, the usual suspects in these sorts of arguments. And, you know, Representative Ivory said the other day he's convinced that it doesn't matter what the legislature does, that the president has such disdain for the states and for Utah in particular, that he's going to go ahead and create the national monument and probably, he says, actually create three national monuments before his term is over.
Well,
the governor was asked specifically about that, and he says he has no indication that that's the case.
Okay. We don't know if the president is going to actually do this. We do know that Interior Secretary Sally Jewell is coming to Utah, as you mentioned. So what's going to happen in the intervening months? I guess do we know when that is scheduled, that visit?
I think it's late June or July. I can't remember. I'm sorry. I should know that. But
so should I.
So I think here's the situation, and I'm kind of reading tea leaves on this as much as anybody. The president leaves office in January, and he has that window of time in which he can designate this national monument. I think he wants to give time for Representative Bishop's Public Lands Initiative to see where it goes and see if they can come to an agreement on it. But I also, the sense I get from people that I talk to on both sides of this issue is that if that doesn't get traction here in the near future, that the president has a strong incentive to go ahead and create that national monument before he leaves. And so So that gives, I guess that gives Representative Bishop and Representative Chaffetz a little bit of momentum to get, you know, to step on the gas on this thing. But also, you know, I think it also means that the opponents are going to be working frantically to try to oppose this. And at the end of the day, I think one way or another, there's going to be protection for that land. And most likely, given the way Congress works, it'll probably be a national monument.
Mm. Let's move to another part of the interim session this week. We heard about reconsideration of programs that the governor had previously vetoed. And Rachel, what are these programs we're talking about?
It's some online software educational programs, some expansion of some existing programs, like Upstart is a for young children, sort of a extra schoolwork, basically, extra teaching. Its proponents say that it's not meant to replace teachers, it's not meant to replace parents at home. It's just supposed to supplement learning. And this would have allowed an expansion of that program. Governor Herbert vetoed the budgetary request for that and sort of faced some blowback. And so he said, okay, I'll reconsider and let's discuss it in the interim session. And they discussed it and voted to say, yeah, we still want this money. So
any details from that discussion that didn't come out in the legislative session? Anything new?
Not really. Basically, people saying this is a useful program. These are useful programs. You know, it's important that, you know, one of the sort of programs that was Governor Herbert sort of pointed out specifically during his veto was this ProStart cooking competition, and part of the new money would be going toward it, like basically a little reality TV show for these sort of local teen chefs. And he said, like, why? Well, I don't want to fund a reality TV show. But it came up in discussion that it's really the equivalent of like a athletics competition for these kids who want to be chefs instead of soccer players. So, you know, some nuance like that, but nothing incredibly new.
Bottom line, the vetoes really never happened.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, I think what happened was the governor kind of got caught flat-footed, and he was going to get the legislature was going to override his vetoes. It was guaranteed that was going to happen, and so the governor kind of, in an effort to sort of save face, said, "Well, let's have a special session. We'll go ahead and pass them all again." And so that's what they ended up doing. It wasn't necessarily that new information came out; just that it's politics, I guess.
Politics, politics. Speaking of politics, federal officials announced some rules about accommodations for transgender students. That came up on Capitol Hill. Small protest. Rachel, remind our listeners first, what was in the administration's letter to school districts?
It's basically a dear colleague letter saying, this is what you should be doing. You should be providing accommodation to students who are transgender. Everyone should have a bathroom that they feel comfortable using, and no one should feel you shouldn't prioritize someone feeling uncomfortable over someone having the right to use the bathroom that they want to.
And this goes for locker rooms. Gendered areas of a school.
Exactly.
Okay. Robert, you're reporting this morning that the governor commented on this in his monthly address.
Yeah, yeah.
What was his message?
Well, he has said previously when the letter came out, he said he would condemned it, I guess, strongly, saying that the state will fight it. It's not the federal government's role to be telling the states how they should be managing their restrooms and their locker rooms, and that it should be left to the local schools and the local districts. He also said yesterday that he's concerned that forcing this issue could exacerbate the bullying problems in the schools, and so I think the thinking being that if you force it down people's throats, there's going to be a backlash, and that some of the kids may end up suffering. Like I said, he said the threat from the federal government is that they give the state a lot of money in federal funding for these for schools, and there's been a strong suggestion at least that they would withhold some of that funding if states don't comply with the directions from the Department of Education and Department of Justice. And so he said that would be a mistake, and that the state will fight it, and that he wants to have the local governments and local districts deciding how to manage these bathrooms. The legislature also received a letter. Legislative leaders asked the Education Committee to study this over the next few months, the impacts on the schools in complying with this letter, or the impacts if they do not comply with the letter as well, I guess, and also the impacts on the students who actually have to use the facilities.
Mm. A lot of hand-wringing among the political class. What about educators, Rachel?
A lot of educators are saying no big deal. We've had transgender bathrooms or general neutral bathrooms for many years, and it's been happening, and people aren't freaking out, so there's no reason to be upset now. There is a district in Utah County that has its school board members have drafted a letter saying that it's morally reprehensible to allow transgender students to use the bathrooms that are consistent with their gender identity.
This would be the Alpine School District.
Yep.
The Mormon Church kind of, sort of, weighed in on this issue. What did they say, Rachel?
Basically that it's, you know, people should be treated kindly. You know, they're, I mean, that's the what a lot of their statements say.
Okay. And what about the State Office of Education or the State School Board? Are we hearing intentions from them?
Well, they released a statement the day of the directive basically saying that they're not going to be forcing local districts to do anything, and that they will sort of be thinking about this and looking at this in the months to come.
I'll add that this is not really a new issue, that this is something that has been talked about at the Capitol for years, because ever since the anti-discrimination ordinance was discussed initially, this has been a concern that opponents have said that, well, if we pass this anti-discrimination ordinance and we tell transgender kids they can't use the bathroom, then, you know, then we're going to get sued over this. And so this has been a sort of a boogeyman it's sort of been waiting in the wings. It's been forced into the national attention, I think, by what North Carolina and what was the other state, Texas, that they have done recently. So yeah, it's become a national issue. It's become, not surprisingly, I guess, in a political election year that's going to be even more politicized. And I think, as Rachel mentioned, it's something that districts have been able to manage adequately over the last several years. And frankly, my kids go to a school where this is an issue, and one of the children uses the faculty restroom. They make accommodations.
Mm. We need to head to a break, but before we do, I want to get to one other interim session issue. Water managers delivered some eye-popping numbers when it comes to water. Emma, you were there. What'd you find out?
You know, they were saying they have a problem with a backlog for maintenance issues. They have old dams and pipes and wells that all need repairs, or they need to be refurbished, or they need to be replaced. And they say that if you total this all up across the state, that there is $18 billion of maintenance and repairs that needs to be done by the year 2060. They said that given their current estimates, they believe that the requirements to do this maintenance will increase people's water rates or quadruple people's water rates in the next 40 to 50 years was their estimates.
Quadruple? So what's the solution there then? I guess they need the state to step up. Is that what they're asking?
Yes. They have asked the state to provide up to 20% of that estimated $18 billion through the form of a revolving loan fund. They are assuming that they will get that funding when they say that water rates will quadruple. They are taking that into account with that estimate.
Okay. We're going to hear some more details, I'm sure, about that. But critics think, well, maybe that $18 billion is a little overinflated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, critics feel like there's some chance here that the numbers are being exaggerated. They say that the state maybe is not taking into account the fact that those projects are maybe more already funded or more easily funded than the water districts are letting on. And some state lawmakers weren't too keen on the idea.
All right. We'll continue to follow that very closely at the Tribune. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll head to a break and be right back in a minute.
This is going to sound like I'm making it up, but what you're about to hear was actually part of producing a major motion picture.
The amount of fizz that comes out of Matilda's butt, you know, how explosive that egg is.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, Angry Birds, the movie, and how all that animation gets made. It's next time on Marketplace.
Join us tonight at 6:30 on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Cafe Ibis Roasting Company, second annual Randy Worth Half Century Ride, Saturday, May 21st, proceeds to benefit enhanced bird habitats and build a downtown bike hub. Registration information at randyworthhcr.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce here in studio with Emma Penrod, Rachel Piper, and Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune. And joining us from her home, I believe in Ogden, is Jessica Miller, a justice reporter. Jessica, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for being here. You've been busy this week. Salt Lake Tribune has been reporting for weeks about how BYU handles rape cases. And this week, you got some new evidence in the case of one of those women who came forward to challenge the school's protocol with regard to the Honor Code office. What'd you find out, Jessica?
So we had reported last month that the sheriff's deputy, his name is Edwin Randolph, had turned over the rape case. He'd been given the case from an acquaintance who he knew who was the accused rapist. So he took that case file to BYU's Honor Code office, and they began trying to investigate the victim in this case. And so since then, there's been a lot of conflicting reasons offered for why Randolph did that. His attorney has said that he wanted male students investigated, and the Utah County Sheriff has said that he wanted to protect female athletes. So we filed a bunch of open records requests with Provo Police and other entities, and we found out basically what Randolph told BYU and Provo Police is that he wanted the alleged victim, Maddie Barney, investigated and that he didn't believe her.
So can you give us a couple of precise quotes from the tapes, exactly what he said?
Sure, yeah. There's a summary of the notes that were taken by the Title IX coordinators, and in those notes, he's quoted as saying that Barney wants to screw up the suspect's life, and then he later tells the police detective who's questioning him that he told Title IX officers that I think someone's doing something that needs to be questioned. She goes to BYU, lives in BYU housing, and is playing around and doing all this stupid stuff, and I think it's a problem. And when the detective had asked him, you know, what he thought would happen after he gave this file over to the school, he acknowledges that sometimes they'll suspend you, sometimes they'll kick you out of school. And that tip did trigger an honor code investigation of the victim. And she's refused to participate at the advice of prosecutors. And so she's been blocked from enrolling from her classes in the fall.
Hmm. What can you tell us about the deputy sheriff, Edwin Randolph? What do we know about him? How long has he served on the force?
He's been with the Utah County Sheriff's Office for almost 20 years. And his law enforcement certification kind of limits him to being jailer. He works at the jail. And the sheriff said that, you know, because of this limited certification that he has, he doesn't quite understand or have a full knowledge of laws and federal codes and regulations and what constitutes a restricted document and maybe shouldn't be given to BYU or other people outside of the case. And, you know, as a result of this, they did an internal investigation at the sheriff's office, and they found the only violation of office policy that he did was interacting with this rape suspect outside of the jail after the suspect was booked into jail, and he was suspended for 2 days for that violation.
But I believe you reported that state officials are looking into his behavior. Am I right?
Post? Yes, yeah. POST, which is the Utah Peace Officer Standards and Training, they're the ones who, they'll do their own investigation now, and they'll basically decide whether his actions should affect his certification as law enforcement officer.
Yeah, the Tribune, of course, does not normally identify victims of sexual assault, but in this case, Maddie Barney came forward. You say she's not cooperating with the Honor Code investigation. How is all of this affecting her?
Yeah, well, she was told by the prosecutor not to do this Honor Code investigation because they're looking to go to trial on this rape case, and they don't want her testimony tainted. They don't want her re-victimized. And so because of that, now she can't register for school. And then, you know, with this case with Randolph, he was charged with witness retaliation, and then the county attorney dropped that, or asked for that charge to be dropped, saying that there was this internal affairs interview that Randolph gave that cleared him of wrongdoing, but he can't tell anybody what was said in that interview, including Maddie Barney. So she kind of feels betrayed by that this charge was dismissed, and she doesn't even understand what happened. No one's told her what was said that caused the case to be dismissed.
Hmm. Our colleague Aaron Alberty has also been working on various threads of this story. You can find a couple of those stories out today, sltrib.com. Rachel, first, many victims have come forward saying that BYU presumed that they were guilty somehow when they disclosed what had happened to them. Mm-hmm. Can you give us just a couple of examples that we've heard?
So in a lot of the cases, during the interview, a student will say, you know, I told him no, I didn't, you know, or he hit me, you know, he hit me and then had sex with me. You know, I said no, basically making it fairly clear that it was an unwilling sexual encounter. And according to them, honor code officials sort of said, okay, what were you wearing? Why were you in his room? Why were you at this time of night? Sort of just basically treating their honor code violations with the same weight as basically that an unwilling sexual encounter had incurred, which under Utah law is rape.
Again, story after story. Check it out, sltrib.com. Brigham Young University, of course, owned by the LDS Church. And they issued a statement yesterday specifically labeling the Tribune coverage as gotcha journalism. Can you expand on the statement? What did they say?
They said that they were not given the opportunity to comment on a story that we published a couple of weeks ago about sort of rape culture and how some teachings and past doctrines of Mormonism have maybe contributed to victims feeling like they weren't victims, but you know, guilty after having been sexually assaulted, and contributing to bishops and other leaders sort of laying that guilt upon them. So they took issue with not being asked to comment on that, and also were upset this week that Aaron's story that is in today's paper was posted online yesterday morning without a comment from them.
So did the church statement dispute any elements of the reporting itself, or just that the church had not been given an opportunity to respond?
Basically that they had not been given an opportunity to respond. And it did say that these stories are basically the exception, that most women don't experience this.
So when they were given an opportunity to respond, did they?
As far as I know, I haven't been in the office since yesterday, last night. Questions that Aaron asked of BYU as of Wednesday morning had not been answered.
We're also reporting this morning that BYU created a new website. What's that about?
Yeah, so they announced a few weeks ago, sort of after this was all being reported, that they wanted to reevaluate the relationship between their Title IX office and their Honor Code office, which is what a lot of students said was the problem for them. They'd go to Title IX to report that they'd been sexually assaulted, and that investigation would get turned over to the Honor Code office, which would then sort of would be the entity sort of sticking them for these infractions of honor code. BYU said that they're going to be looking at that relationship specifically. They haven't really been clear about what, you know, a lot of people have been calling for an amnesty clause, but BYU has not said that that's one of the things they're pursuing, just that they are pursuing changes. Yesterday they announced that they've formed a committee that will be looking at the issues and specifically at these responses that the public and people who are affiliated with BYU, whether alumni or faculty or current students, what they want to see changed. And people can go to the website. We have a link up on our website to BYU's survey, and people who have relationships with BYU can answer that, and it'll get sent to these committee members who will be looking at those in the coming months to decide what needs to be changed, if anything.
Really some stunning coverage and continuing coverage online, sltrib.com, if you want any more background on that. Before I let Jessica go, Jessica, you've been working on a very intriguing case this week, a kidnapping case involving a father, a son, a UTA driver. It really has investigators and many Utahns trying to figure out exactly what happened. First off, tell us about the father and son who, after this extensive manhunt, are now in custody. What do police believe that they did?
So police believe, I think it was sometime last week, they tied up a mother and her four teenage daughters in a home in Centerville, kidnapped them, basically. And the women got out of the home, and then this father and son fled. And so the next time they see them, the police find them in Wyoming. They've been camping out in Wyoming. And in the meantime, this UTA maintenance worker had been missing. So on Tuesday, they found the UTA worker's body out in Wyoming. And then just yesterday, they found his truck out there as well. So now the police are trying to kind of piece together if these are connected. They believe they are connected, but there hasn't been any evidence, strong evidence that we've been told about anyways yet, that's certainly linking the two cases together. But as the Centerville police chief said yesterday, if they're not connected, it would be a huge coincidence.
Flint and Derek Harrison, father and son, what are the suspected motives? Why did they kidnap these women?
Well, the police believe that it was kind of meth-fueled paranoia, that they thought that this mother had told the police about their drug use. So they believe that's the motive for that part of their alleged crime.
So Kay Ricks, the UTA driver who was found dead, does he have any link to Flint and Derek Harrison that we know of?
Not that I'm aware of, not that the police have said publicly. I think that if they are connected, it's probably just one of those, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time kind of situation. But the police haven't gone that far to say that yet.
Do we know when investigators will be revealing a little bit more information? It's sort of been dribbling out throughout the week.
Right. I'm not sure, actually. I know that they are on Wyoming. They're going to be looking at the truck now, looking at evidence, seeing if there's anything that can tell them anything about Rick's homicide and whether these Harrisons are involved. And so here in Utah, the Harrisons are in custody in the Davis County Jail, and they'll face charges on kidnapping and a whole host of other charges. So while they're doing that here, Centerville Police said that will give the Wyoming authorities the time and the space that they need to do the homicide investigation without having to rush to file charges to keep the father and son in custody.
It's such a strange turn of events, and you can find all the details at sltrib.com. Jessica Miller joining us on the line. Thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in Salt Lake City. Apparently, we're having some problems with the phone lines, but if you want to comment on any of the stories that we're talking about, go online, sltrib.com, or you can tweet using the hashtag TribTalk. Let's turn to the environment. Emma, scientists met this week in Salt Lake City to discuss the condition of our beloved landscape, the Bonneville Salt Flats. What did you find out?
Well, there were scientists there from the University of Utah, but there were also representatives of various lawmakers and a large contingent of individuals representing the International Land Speed Racing Community, which uses the Bonneville Salt Flats multiple times a year for kind of racing events. They aren't racing at the same time. They try to see who can get their car to go the fastest in a given distance, not like a race with multiple cars going. But so they
a race against time.
Yes, it's like a time trial, and they all gathered Tuesday all day long to discuss what the land speed racers are saying is the decline and deterioration of the Bonneville Salt Flats over the case of many decades, and what they've found preliminarily, and it's very preliminary, but scientists from the University of Utah had gone over satellite data and had found that there is, although it's choppy, some years it's better, some years it's worse, what they found is that over the last 30 years or so, there is a gradual decline in the area covered by salt at the Bonneville Salt Flats. They also found that the quality of the salt seems to be degrading, in that they find these patchy spots of mud. The salt crust isn't continuous as it used to be. And also that there is encroachment of vegetation onto the salt flats, which they said was indicative of maybe some changes to how water interacts with the landscape.
Are they making connection to a changing climate? Are they saying that the toll of mining is impacting this landscape? What are the theories out there?
At this point, I don't know that there's a solid theory that anyone is posing. That, with the exception of the land speed racers who are saying that this is the fault of the BLM, which has allowed mining industry near the salt flats to continue to take out too much salt without being required to replenish and put back what they have removed. But the scientists say that there's no strong correlation between the mining efforts and the effort by the mine there to put salt back on the salt flats and the actual area, at least, covered by the salt flats. In fact, they said they can't find a correlation with anything. Another thing that has been said is that maybe when it rains, if it rains a lot more than usual, that it causes the salt flats to not be as salty. And they said there's no correlation there that they could find.
So basically, we don't really know what's going on.
No, there isn't a lot of strong scientific proof that anyone can point to pinpoint that this is happening.
So if we don't know why this is happening, can we fix it?
Well, the land speed racers believe that the obvious solution here is to require Intrepid Potash, that is the closest mine to the area where they have their race course, the International Speedway. They believe that if you required that company to pump more salt, they already pump about 500,000 tons of salt onto the salt flats every winter, which they chose to do as part of an experimental study. That study was supposed to increase the salt crust by 2 inches, but subsequent studies couldn't find any increase, so some see it as not being a successful program. The land speed racers, though, say that they did see improvement, and they believe that if they were just to put more, say, in excess of 1 million tons of salt onto the salt flats each year, then they would see the reversal of this decline and that conditions would improve. The BLM and the scientific community, they feel like it would be better to hold off until we really understand what's happening there. They say pumping more salt onto the salt flats, which is done in a solution with water and other minerals, they believe that could actually cause more damage, depending on what the circumstances out there are.
Just as a sidebar to this main story about the research, you reported earlier this week that the BLM, which sponsored these meetings, didn't want these meetings open to the public. What's going on there?
It's not entirely clear what happened there. What I was initially told by the BLM and what I have been told others were told initially by the BLM is that media in particular was to be barred from entering this meeting. They were going to be allowed to sit outside the room and talk to people if they came outside the room, but they were not to be allowed into the room. And there was to be no recording or record keeping filming in the room while the proceedings were happening. We have been told that this was at the request of a stakeholder. It's not entirely clear who asked for that, but evidently somebody asked that the talks not be anything official on the record.
Well, you ended up attending. Was there anything super top secret about what you heard?
You know, I didn't feel like there was anything said there that seemed terribly top secret. There were plenty of disclosures of this is preliminary data or I'm not an official spokesman. Nobody wanted to be pinned down to what happened at that meeting. But other than that, it seemed to be a pretty straightforward conversation of asking questions and sharing information about what do we know is happening out there. And what do we not know, and what do we want and can realistically do about it?
Well, I guess my final question for you is, will the Salt Flats be in a position to host speed racing this year?
It's difficult to say this early in the season. That's something that's usually decided a little bit later. The salt flats go through these flood cycles every year, where in usually spring, winter, you know, they get water on the salt flats, and the salt is kind of dissolved, and it turns into this muddy, watery mix. And then over the summer, when it heats up, that evaporates off the salt flats, and it leaves that salt crust that everyone, you know, is familiar with and that the salt flats are famous for. So there's a lot of unknown at this point. They're still in the flood stage. There's still water on the flats. But the mayor of Wendover, who obviously lives out by the salt flats, said that things seem to be shaping up pretty good so far.
Okay. We're talking about Utah's top stories, and we need to take another quick break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Salt Lake City, throughout the state on Utah Public Radio.
Utah Public Radio would like to congratulate Nadra Hafar, Education Curator in the Utah State University Nora Eccles Harrison Museum of Art, for receiving a certification from the Utah Division of Arts and Museums. Hafar is now certified with the Change Leader Institute, which works to help advance communities through art and culture. Kudos from Utah Public Radio.
I'm Robin Young. Oneida, it's a town, it's a silverware company, and it was a religious free love utopia, one of many after the Industrial Revolution turned America upside down.
So all of the traditional touchstones by which people were able to identify themselves, be it spiritual or religious or economic, were really up for grabs, and I think this was both exciting and terrifying at the same time.
Next time, here and now.
Join us this morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Let's end up the hour with a report from the campaign trail. Robert, you first reported a few weeks the governor's fundraising tactics were raising some eyebrows. I don't know if we've had a chance to talk about it. What did he do?
Well, so a few days after he was beaten at the state Republican convention, the governor had a meeting at the Alta Club with somewhere in the neighborhood of about 30 to 40 lobbyists and supporters to sort of lay out his game plan for the 8 weeks leading up to the Republican primary on June 28th. And at this meeting, coming out of the meeting the next day, we heard that there were some things said that were sort of raised some eyebrows. Let's put it that way. Mm. And you know, essentially, it was downplayed by the campaign at the time. And then in last week, we got audio recording of a portion of the meeting, and it's interesting to listen to, if nothing else. I mean, you've got the governor's finance director who was laying out this plan of we referred to it initially as speed dating. The campaign objects to that term, but where. They went to a lobbyist's office and sat for 2 hours, and the lobbyist brought in seven clients who brought in checks of a neighborhood of about $5,000 each, gave the checks to the campaign, and met with the governor for 20 minutes, as the finance director put it, to talk specifically about their issues. That's getting into a gray area on at least ethically, if not legally. And the governor also sort of jumped in and said, I'm available. I'm available to go where you want me to go. You know, I'm turning over control of the state to Justin Harding, who's his chief of staff, and Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox, and I'm available to go where you want me to go. I'm available Jones, he put it. Available Jones was
who is available?
Available Jones. I had no idea who Available Jones was.
Neither did I.
If nothing else, I think we've discovered the governor needs to update his cultural references a little bit. But Available Jones is a character from the cartoon, the comic strip Little Abner, if you remember Daisy May and Dog Patch and all that.
Not really.
No, nobody does. And Available Jones was the sort of the jack of all trades who would do anything for a price. He was available to his friends for a price. And so it was sort of an unfortunate selection of a reference for the governor to make. But you know, he said he's willing to do this. And then there was one lobbyist who kind of said, well, you know, I'm not sure my clients would be comfortable with bringing checks to meetings to discuss policy issues. You know, that's not really the way it's done. And both the lieutenant governor and the governor jumped in and said, there's no quid pro quo. We're not going to, you know, this is not, you know, but we'll, you know, if you want. But he went on to say, well, if you want to bring the check before or give me the check after the meeting, you know, we can make that work for you guys. We've just got to raise the money is what he said. And their goal is to raise $1 million before June 1st. So we're closing in on their deadline. I'm not sure if they're going to make it, but they wanted to raise $1 million before June 1st for this primary battle they're having with Jonathan Johnson. And so it's created kind of a stir. I mean,
Herbert says, look, I'm not a rich man. I have to raise money.
I'm running
against rich guys.
Yeah. And Jonathan Johnson is wealthy. He's received hundreds of thousands of dollars from Patrick Byrne, who's the CEO of Overstock. And so, you know, Herbert says he doesn't have the financial personal wealth to, but he also had about $750,000 in the bank at the end of after the primary or leading up to the primary, or not the primary, I'm sorry, leading up to the convention. And so, you know, he had a significant financial advantage anyway. The incumbent governor rarely has much trouble raising money. It's just raised questions about how candidates go about raising funds for their campaigns. And House Speaker Greg Hughes during the Republican caucus on Wednesday felt like he needed to caution members of the Republican caucus not to, never trust anybody, that we could always be recorded, and anything you say can and will be leaked to the press. You have to
That's
go
what
in
it
with
means
that
to
assumption.
Be a public official.
And B, that, you know, we don't, you know, he said there was a time in an interview afterward, he said that, you know, there was a time where we did have policy discussions. People would come in for a breakfast and discuss their issues and say, oh, by the way, you're running for re-election. Here's a check. They brought in an ethics and campaign finance attorney about 5 years ago when Speaker Lockhart was still Speaker, and he warned them that you know, increasingly has been come under scrutiny by law enforcement officials when you do that, and you need to keep those two things separate. And the Speaker said that they've been making considerable effort since then to try to separate those two things, the fundraising component and the policy component. And in fact, the Speaker sponsored legislation a couple years ago that prohibited fundraising on the Capitol grounds. Because, you know, he said that needs to be a place where they only talk policy, they don't talk finance, campaign finance. So,
well, Herbert's opponents are taking full advantage of this gaffe. Can you start on the Republican side? Challenger Jonathan Johnson is just hammering Governor Herbert on this.
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan Johnson said that he was so upset about when he heard the recording that he was shaking. He said that it was disgusting and it was offensive, and it shows that this is what happens when you have career politicians who are trying to hold on to their office. A supporter of Jonathan Johnson, the former Harriman mayor, Joshua Mills, has filed a complaint with the Lieutenant Governor's office, the Attorney General, and the District Attorney, asking for them to investigate whether the laws were broken, whether this rises to the level of bribery, basically, is what he's asking them to look at. I suspect that the Johnson campaign will continue to hammer this as it goes forward. On the Democratic side, Michael Weinholz has had a press conference the other day at the Capitol where he said he's not going to take money from corporations or lobbyists or special interest groups. Michael Weinholz, it should be noted, has given his campaign $1 million, so it makes it a little bit easier to kind of make those sweeping statements. And he says, you know, that the governor has put a for sale sign on the state capitol building, which is sort of harkens back to during the Swallow and Shurtleff investigation, the investigators said that Attorney General Swallow put a for sale sign on the door of the Attorney General's office. I think he's trying to draw a comparison there.
So the real question is, did the governor do anything illegal?
Well,
and that's being investigated, right?
Well, presumably there will be some investigation done because of this request from the Jonathan Johnson campaign.
Is that an ethics investigation or a legal investigation?
It would be a legal investigation. If there was an ethics complaint filed, there's a separate executive ethics committee that would handle that. Utah law on fundraising is pretty flimsy in terms of, you know, it doesn't pretty much anybody can give what they want to whom they want to, you know, any time they want, except, well, not any time they want. There is a blackout period during the legislative session and for the governor during the bill signing period. But there aren't a lot of restrictions on who can give what when. And so, you know, was the law broken? It seems unlikely because there weren't favors given or promised. There was clearly access granted, and so that's where you can probably kind of start creeping into a gray area. But so far, nobody outside of, I guess, this complaint to the LG and the AG alleging bribery has kind of claimed that there was a law broken.
We need to get to our final segment, yeah. But I want to ask finally, as we look to June 28th for the primary, how is this Available Jones episode going to affect the governor's electability? He's gone into the polls with very healthy numbers, but what are political insiders saying?
Well, I mean, this is the sort of mistake he did not need. I mean, the polls showed he had about a 55-point lead in the most recent one. Even if it's half that, a 27-point lead is a healthy lead. All you have to do is sort of run out the clock. This is an unforced error, and it's going to hurt the governor, and I'm sure the Johnson campaign is going to make full use of it. I'm sure there'll probably be radio ads or TV ads making it, you know, with playing on the Available Jones thing. And so he has to weather this. The good news for him, I guess, or maybe it's bad news, is the voting by mail starts on June 6th and runs through the 28th. And so, you know, it's the window is going to be opening soon for people to start casting their ballots. And I think, we'll see what the net effect is. But the governor has a pretty healthy lead in the most recent polling.
Okay. Stay tuned. SLTrib.com. Very short segment, our final segment, the underplayed story of the week. Emma, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. So story that caught my eye this morning. There is a exhibit at the Natural History Museum right now all about DNA. And the human genome. Maybe doesn't sound terribly interesting, but the highlight here that got my attention, there is part of this exhibit focuses on the genome in Utah, and in particular on research that has been completed because of the contributions of Utahns. Apparently, Utahns are an important source of genetic research in that they have large families and they tend to have long family trees. They do a lot of genealogy. I guess part of this exhibit is you can go and you can look at these family trees that have been researched, and if you want, you can add your own information. So that
sounds like pretty cool. Rachel Piper.
The Hogle Zoo this week unveiled its new lion cubs.
You gotta love the lions.
And I don't think that story was underplayed, but I don't think you can ever have enough adorable lion cubs. So check it out. Wonderful photos, and Mike Gurrell wrote a really awesome story.
I agree. Robert Gerke.
My underplayed story of the week is that this will be Jennifer Napier Pierce's last week hosting Behind the Headlines. She'll be missed. She's, you know, kicked this program, not just this program, but Trib Talk, took it from nothing and built it up into something that I think is valuable for our listeners and our viewers, and we'll miss her.
You're going to make me cry.
We're all going to cry.
All right, that's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, production of KCPW, UPR, and Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks for listening. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Have a great weekend.
Good luck.
If tune rhythms are about dance, song beats are usually about something more practical, the rhythms of work, lyrics taking a back seat to the purpose of lightening the load and keeping the singer on track. Get into the rhythm of the song on the Thistle and Shamrock.
Join us tonight at 9 on Utah Public Radio.
You're listening to Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan. Also heard at upr.org.